Hi everybody, good evening. Hope everybody's well and had a wonderful Shabbat and weekend, and beginning the week with some good time with Torah. Why are you planning a surprise party or something?
No, I asked because I got called out for not really.
Gotcha. Coming. Yeah, massive call out. Okay, right, let's begin. So, although the title of the shiur is Romeo and Juliet Bahalacha, which you don't require a massive cultural knowledge in order to work out what that question is, we're going to get a specific question towards the end of the shiur. But until then, we are building the broad background. I want everyone to actually really be done lekaf zechut for me, that I know that Donnie has got her big guitar thing lesson until 6:15 every week, and so I want to make sure that she doesn't walk in too late, and that's why I always endeavour now. So Donnie, you've missed all of 30 seconds of the shiur. Okay, really what we're going to be spending the majority of the time on before we get to Romeo and Juliet in 15th century Italy is the broad background question of when one of your parents asks you to do something for them. What are the boundaries of that? How far does one have to go in simply responding positively to one's parents' request? Does it have a limit? So just a single source before we get into the main thing, just to show one of the most important yisod, certainly in the halakha, but all the more so just in the general way we think about this. Tani avim ibrei de Rabbi Avahu, yesh ma'achil la'aviv pisyono. There are people who feed their father, their parents, the greatest delicacies that they are. And nevertheless, v'tordo min ha'olam, they are thrown out of this world. In the Yerushalmi's version, yoshim gehenom, they find themselves in gehenom, in hell, even though they have fed their parents the most choice of foods. Yesh matchino b'rechayim, there are people who literally grind with the stone, meaning the most basic food they give their parents. They're not giving their parents luxuries whatsoever. They're giving them just the most very basic means of sustenance. And nevertheless, mevio l'chaye olam haba, through that act they inherit the world to come. The Yerushalmi gives an example of both of these stories. In the first case, a person feeds his father, sort of, this is Chazal's classic delicacy food, fattened chickens, taranagolim ufutamim, which we sing about on Shabbat. And the father says, wow, where did you get these from? And the son says something like, father, just shut up and eat, just like a dog requires its food, so too I'm giving you your food. And then it goes on to tell an opposite story of a person bereft of any money who has to sort of slave in order to give his father just the most basic food and does some sort of act where he's called away and, you know, out of his father's honor, you know, still makes sure he's able to give his father this basic food. What is the idea lying behind this simple agadata? It is as follows. Lo ha'akta chitzoni. It's got nothing to do really with the external Maaser, that was weird, I just flipped my languages from Hebrew to English. It's been a heavy couple of days. It is not the external action that a person takes which is the final difference. Rather, it is the intention and it is the atmosphere behind it. And you don't need to look far. You certainly don't need to go all the way back to Agadotot and the Bavli and the Yerushalmi to understand this point. But and notice that both of these stories are about not just parents in general, but specifically elderly parents. The way in which we treat the elderly in our society is one of the most unthought about questions in politics and in our society as a whole. And you don't really have to look far to see examples which are really, really disgraceful of how elderly people are treated. I was just with a friend the other week. He's an academic on sabbatical from Israel. And that he's at Columbia, but actually hasn't really had much time to be at Columbia at all because his parents in Maryland have been very unwell. And he told me just the, you know, part of what has been so frustrating is seeing how doctors relate to his father, who is a deeply intelligent man, you know, very, very cultured and sophisticated, who has got quite a severe form of cancer. And he asked the doctor, with my friend sitting next to him, a number of questions which didn't have sort of like an immediate sort of point-blank answer in the way in which, you know, doctors might like to answer. You know, they were at a certain level of generality. The guy's in his 90s. And after he had asked these questions lucidly and coherently, the doctor turns to my friend, who's in his 40s, and says, "This is just why I love working with old people. They're so cute, right?" And Noah said to me, like, you know, I just wanted to respond, like, do you know, like, the spiritual depth that this man has that you have got no idea of how to access? Do you know who this man is compared to, you know, how you're treating him just as an infant? And without getting into politics too much, I think it's something very important to realise when, you know, we speak so much of marginalised groups and the like. The only, when you know, a group is in the news that it is marginalised or it's suffering from discrimination, which may very well be a very justified cause, they're almost only ever in the news because that group is able to make noise, and that's a good thing. But think of all the groups who, you know, very frequently, you know, might suffer very, you know, significant discrimination, but are just actually have no voice whatsoever. And it's hard to think of a group which is less able to politically and socially organise than the elderly. So sorry, that is my bit of a rant that was going around my head based on that single line. But that is the overarching idea behind this whole discussion, that it's not the external act which matters at the end of the day, rather it's the atmosphere and the intention behind that. Having said all that, what are the boundaries which out some sort of line which tells us at which point, up until which point are we continually obligated to obey our parents, and at what point can we say, sorry mum, sorry dad, I'm not going to do this. So let's read the first source. This is a very major source which only appears now at this stage after we've been through many agadotot. This is the first time which we get a real sense of something actually halachic in the sugya. It has to appear within the wider agadic context, as we've spoken about many times. That's the nature of this topic. Source number two, Tanu Rabbanan, Ezuhu Mora v'Ezuhu Kibud. Right, we've said there are two sort of fundamental principles behind relating to parents. There's not just Kibud, honouring them, there's also Mora, reverence. Well, what does that practically mean, Mora and Kibud? Mora, lo omed bimkomo, not to stand in their place, v'lo yoshev bimkomo, not to sit in their place. That could be, you know, if there's a certain place where they sit in shul or at the table, and that's sort of seen as their the parents' specific place. And if you take it, that's an act of showing a lack of reverence for them. You might think of in a couple of weeks' time, right? Not this week's parasha, next week's parasha of Reuven and his father. V'lo soter et dvarav, not to contradict one's parents. V'lo machrio. Kibud, what is kibud? What is honouring one's parents? Ma'achil v'mashke, giving them food, giving them drink. Malbish u'machaseh, providing them with clothes if they are to need. Machnis u'motzi, taking them out and bringing them in. That is all we have in terms of the halakha, actually spelling out what it is we have to do. And let's just put this question out very briefly. Do you read this as a sort of a limited list, this and no more? Or do you read it as a sort of just giving examples list, but which it's in theory just giving several examples of potentially hundreds, and is therefore incredibly expansive? And where would you put a line in between those two, in between those two options? Nelly?
I would say it's somewhere in between, because I don't think just these things very specifically, but at the same time, it doesn't seem like there's something very specific about all of these things in common that wouldn't make it like an infinite set. It would just be like things that I guess almost like pertain very directly to your parents' life. Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good. Finchas?
I was going to say something similar to what she just finished off with. That specifically, kibud, which is like the requests aspect, is not every request. It's requests specifically pertaining to their needs. as mm-hmm. opposed to just, you know, perhaps peering into the future at this year, as opposed to them talking about your actions. That's not what's mentioned here.
Okay, very good. Anybody want to take a more expansive view, Avi?
Well, I think in the Psukim and Kiddushin, Kiddushin.
That's a very firm thing to say.
Psukim, Kiddushin, mm-hmm. It's kind of funny. I think Rashi, because there are two different, like Psukim, it's Kavir Avicha and Ishimo Vavitirahu, and then mm-hmm. I remember that Rashi says for Mora, that's more of like when their parents are like that's like when they're younger, and then like, that's when, and then those are all like the halachas of like, let's say when, like when they're like, let's say in their middle age, when like you have to show fear and like awe and reverence, and that, and those are just some examples that expands to like everything within that age. But then kibud is more of a when they're in their older stage, is that those like ma'af and mashke only is only relevant when your parents are much older, but it's like a stage. First it's like more, and like that's the beginning stage of kibud avim, and then the kibud part, like feeding them and then helping them out and getting them dressed, is when they're in their older stage.
That's a nice idea, but what would that do for giving us sort of like Naomi and Pinchas were edging towards giving us sort of some sort of dividing line between what you do for parents and what you don't do?
Well, do that. I think it covers everything. So like,
so it covers
everything for each one.
So it's telling you, this is just the way your way through a life. These are the various things you'll do. Right, examples of potentially infinite ones. Final point, Ben.
I haven't like given this enough thought, but usually I'm inclined to think that each example is really indicative of some larger category.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's not saying like, oh, you just close and it, like if they need them, but you know, clothes are like a higher level than something like food, and you start breaking it down where like there's like primary needs, like to stay alive, or there's like needs of like dignifying them or bringing them out. Could be like, you know, if my parents don't really know anything about technology, and like bringing them out could be showing them like the larger world, which they're not aware of.
Why to the wise, right? Yeah, fair. Okay, great. So each one, yeah, Nina.
Another thing that I thought is like not only the action that is specified, but the implications of it. So for example, don't like contradict them, not necessarily like decide what that means exactly. The idea of you thinking that you're superior enough to say something against them, like all the implications of mm-hmm. what you said.
Right. Yeah, fair mod. Okay, so let's see what the what other relevant sources have got to see if we have some sort of way of limiting or just dividing this. Very important Gemara in Yevamot for our purposes and in general. Ditanya, Yachol Amar Lo Aviv Hitame. You might have thought that your parents, if you're a Kohen, could tell you, Titame, defile yourself. Osha Amar Lo, speaking about returning lost items. Al Tachzir, right, don't waste your time returning a lost item. Somebody rather pay attention to my needs, a parent might say. In other words, the parent is requesting something which would force the child either to be ovel, to transgress a prohibition, or at least not to do a positive commandment. Yachol Yishamer Lo, I might have thought that you should actually listen to your parents, because Kibud Avim is itself a Torah is itself a commandment. Talmud Lomar, Aish Imo Va'aviv Tirau. This is the verse that Avi mentioned, which we've seen a number of times. The Torah tells us that a person, their mother and their father, they should fear. However, the verse finishes, Et Shabbatotai Tishmoru, and they should keep my Shabbatot. Notice that the Tishmoru is in the plural. In other words, kulchem chayavin bichvodi, all of you, says Hashem, says the Torah. In other words, both parents and children are obligated in my kavod, are honored to show kibud to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right, we spoke in the very first year about how honor is itself sort of built on and parallel to honoring HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but that's only when the two work in tandem. If the two are brought into collision with one another, if there's a choice to be made between honoring your parents and keeping mitzvot, then very clearly says the Gemara, the mitzvot take precedence over that. So there we've got one limitation, right? Kibud Avim does not extend all the way, even to the extent that you should honor your parents rather than being able to keep the mitzvot in the way in which one should. That is one, although seemingly quite limited, restriction. But is that all there is? Does that mean that all that ever is apart from that we would be obligated to listen to our parents. That's sort of implied by the Torah. Here is the Torah show. Source number 4. B'chayav lichvodo b'shar drachav masov matno. One's obligated to their parents in various different ways. V'asiyat cheftso. And just performing their wishes. Right, what a parent tells you to do. Asiyat cheftso. That falls under kibud avem. If that's so, maybe Ben was heading down this line. That's an extremely wide, expansive definition. And if that's so, does that mean that everything that just, as long as it doesn't touch on not being able to fulfill some other aspect of our religious lives, we're obligated to do? So it's at this point that we reach the most important source probably in the discussion. And although it's attributed for the most part to the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo ben Aderet, this is how sort of later Achronim treat it, they treat it as the Rashba's Chiddush, it actually begins a generation earlier in the Rashba's teacher, the Ramban, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, who put an extremely, it's sort of one of those interesting sort of topics where you're either going to have like an extremely maximal definition, you've got to listen to your parents in absolutely everything unless it's like bordering on not being able to keep the rest of your life of mitzvot, or you've got an extremely minimal definition, right? And here is this minimal one. Yeah, sorry, Dana.
Going, I'm going to try to articulate this, but going back to that original one that we were all discussing, the distinction.
Yeah.
You could say that, like, for example, you honor kings with the idea of honoring them, or it's the specific actions that matter. And like the nafkamina, I guess, would be that, like, even if you don't specifically do something that they want, if you do it in an honorable way, that would be okay.
Interesting. Right, so you know, it might be a distinction between actually doing what your parents are asking on the one hand versus not listening to them at all on the other. Right, and finding a middle ground between them. I think that's that's very, very nicely articulated. That's something which, you know, again, this is something we've really spoken about a lot, that is captured much better by Agadata than Halakha. Right, Halakha likes to speak in sort of distinct laws and differences, which is what our focus is today. But we're going to come back to that right at the end. Nemi.
Even just going back to the one that your parents can't, like, you don't have to follow your parents if they make you go against something that's a mitzvah. Like, even that could, like, go different, like, how far that could go. Because, like, it could be, is that saying, like, anything that's not in direct conflict with the mitzvah, or anything that's, like, could, in theory, prevent you from doing a mitzvah you don't have to follow? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I guess it's, like, yeah. Like, which way does that
So what would an example be of the latter? Right.
I mean, there are other examples also that, where it, could prevent you from doing something, but not making it possible.
So that seems to be exactly what the Ramban and the Rashba are coming off. But they, we won't go into the whole details of it, but they essentially come up with the following. They seem to be talking about a father who is just sort of, I don't want to say for the fun of it, but just, you know, sort of saying to his son, do this, do that, you know, expecting his child to obey him without any obvious benefit being accrued to the father on account of it. V'im tomar, says the Ramban, v'ha'lo mikevan she'amar lo aviv, since his father has told him, chamer achar behemtecha zehu kvodo, follow your, leading your animal in a certain direction, and this is honoring him, since you're just doing what your father says. So some sort of just like random action, says the Ramban, Ein ze ikar kibud. This isn't really the core of honoring them. Rather, ela mash amru b'kiddushin, ezhu kibud. What is kibud? The line that we've read, ma'achilo, mashkehu, give them food, give them drink, malbisho, manilo, clothe them, etc. Kol davar sheyesh lo hanabo. Anything that a parent derives benefit from under the category of hana. That falls under the category of kibud. Aval, amar lo la'asot davar. A parent tells a child to do something she'ein lo hana shel klum, which the parent doesn't actually get any benefit out of. They're just telling the child to do it for some other reason, maybe just because they can. Ein ze kibud she'amra Torah. This is not the kavod that the Torah is talking about when it tells a child to honor and to respect their parents, and therefore the child is under no obligation whatsoever to do it. So that now draws the line in a much, much narrower way. It's not obey your parents in every case unless they have told you to do something which would force you to transgress a mitzvah. It's only obey your parent when it comes to something that they are going to get some direct benefit from. Hands being raised. Pinchas.
He doesn't say that that's not considered kibud abeim at all. He says, ein ze ikar kibud. You're still supposed to do it.
Ein ze ikar kibud, he says on the first
it's
line.
It's not the doraisa.
And then he goes on to say, "Aval amar los lasot davar she'ein lo hanah shel klum, ein ze kibud she'amra Torah."
Okay, so it's derabanan.
You're reading that as meaning it's not the doraita. I'm pretty sure that when the phrase occurs in Rishonim of "ein ze x she'amra Torah," that's talking about a complete confusion of obvious, right, and then it's not part of it at all. For instance, Hilchot Yom Tov Perek Vav Halacha Yud Chet of the Rambam, talking about the obligation of Simchat Yom Tov to give food, give drink, not just to your family, but also to people passing by, to people in need, to the poor, to the needy, etc. He then finishes off and says, "Aval Mishno Noel de la Tot Chatzero," somebody who locks the gates of their courtyard and eats and drinks only them and their family. Ein ze Simcha shel mitzvah. This is not the joy of mitzvah. Ela simchat kriso. It's the joy of his stomach. So it's not like saying it's durabanan joy rather than Torah joy. It's not the idea at all.
But that's because he modifies and says rather this is the joy of your stomach, which clearly isn't the Torah. But saying ein ze kibud, he could have just said stop and said ein ze kibud. But why she'amra Torah? Why ein ze ikar kibud from the beginning? It seems to be he's modifying it. He's saying it's.
What do others think? So not talking about liking or not liking, talking about do you find the argument compelling? It's sort of funny because you seem to be arguing exactly against yourself, right? And that this was exactly what Pinchas and Naomi had said at the start. You thought that was evident.
What? No, I said I played devil's advocate.
Right. No, it's always a good way to do it. Yeah, Ben.
Another point is to say that you as a child know for sure the intention of your parents is also presupposing that it might be like a degree of disrespect or assuming that you know everything. Like classic Karate Kid example, he just gets frustrated that, like, you know, you're making him do all these chores for absolutely no reason. Mm-hmm. Little does he know, in his very limited perception, that this is actually directly helping him. So to say that I am doing something and it's bringing you no benefit, I'm not going to do it anymore, is a little bit like disrespecting your parents, saying that I know more.
So you raise a very, very good point of, even if, unlike Pinchas, we are to accept the line that all the Ramban means is, so the Ramban really does mean you're only obligated to accept, to perform your parents' wishes when it touches on some sort of benefit they're derived from it, how on earth can you ever know what that benefit is? I do hear that, and I guess I'm always inclined to say, yes, things are complicated, so who knows? Nevertheless, I think we can also certainly imagine situations where, you know, the parent is telling the child what to do simply, what's the word, capriciously, right? Only, you know, for the point of view of being a demanding parent. I think I can definitely imagine that. And in that case, says the Ramban, says the Rashba, you're under no obligation whatsoever to do as they say. Dorit?
So in terms of like when you get to a stage where like they're older or they aren't like as aware of what they're, I don't know, whatever, any sort of example like that, how does that work when like if you, okay, a small example, if you like are making sure they do certain things on their own and that to them is viewed as a disgrace because you're not helping them out, but it's really for like their benefit, whatever else, like how do you classify something like that?
That really is certainly relations to parents who are elderly and very unwell is really a shiur in its own right. It's definitely an option for next week's shiur. It's based around an agadata in which one of the Amoraim, whose mother seems to essentially lose her mind, basically flees and leaves her. And the way of looking at that, and it's a very powerful and quite painful machloket between the Rambam and the Ravid. But you're right, it comes back to the same point that Ben raised, of the difficulty of saying what is hana'a and intuiting it. But hold the point, we'll come back to it. Two more points before we move on, Nina and Dana. So they get some sort of enjoyment out of the fact
yeah,
that...
Yeah, because you're being successful in their mind, so, why is it not beneficial for them?
You're right, so that's a very, very good question. So if Ben said, who can ever know what hana is, you're saying, well, whatever they ask you to do is, by definition, hana for them. I think, and I'm only realising this now with your question, which has made me focusing on it, I think we need to go back to what Naomi said at the beginning, which is if you look at those instructions in source number 2 of what it is that you do for your parents, they are all very sort of like almost physical based, right? Food, drink, clothing, right? Hana seems to almost be defined in a very tangible way. People hear that? I wouldn't have thought of it as sharply as that unless you'd said it as that. But I think that's the way in which they're describing. So hana, which is simply they enjoying telling you what to do, that's not the hana, which is of halachic significance.
So in one perspective, you wouldn't be responsible for your parents' happiness?
So I'm enjoying all of you seeming so uncomfortable with this, because you'll see in a moment that you're not the only people who felt uncomfortable with this by any means. Just before we meet them, Dana?
To something in your life, is that for them?
Ah, so that is the Romeo and Juliet question, which we'll come to at the end. Everyone's seeming somewhat uncomfortable with this idea that kibud av'em is limited so much in the way in which a simple reading of the Ramban and the Rashabah tells us only to very, very specific actions. So watch now how many are we going to do? One, the Gra, Shut Betzela Chochma, Sefer HaMakne, and maybe the Chazon Ish as well. Very, very quickly, we're going to skim through four ways in which Achronim, really, Gedolei HaAchronim, very much limited this Chiddush.
Can I defend the Ramban?
Please.
Going against it. I think, like, he's not saying that you should in your say everything is hana, but it's like any mitzvah. There's like abusing, like it's not like kibud av'em is so important that the parents are abusing it if they ask for malicious tasks or like asking something. It's like asking something to do something. Like that's now a kibud av'em is a very holy thing and it's very special and very important thing that like your parent can't just like pull that card every single time. Oh, do this because kibud av'em. It's more like, no, you have to, like, kibud av'em, it has to be specific in order for it to be as beautiful as it is. And if it's so general and you can do whatever you want, technically everything's hana, then there's no such thing as kibud av'em. It's more like I'm an indentured slave to my parents.
I think it's spot on. And, you know, obviously we're talking about it in a certain sense because I'm the only one around the table who is actually a parent, and even then of a very young child, everyone else here is not. But just as much as we speak of kibud horim, you're completely right. There is absolutely the opposite area which is just as significant to think about, which is the obligations that parents have to children, right? Completely. We will we'll come back to that. Did you want to add something?
No, I like the last sentence
of which one?
The Ramban.
V'chein ma she'amru.
The examples that he gives are
right.
They wrote.
Right.
Meaning that maybe the end of the sentence is just that the things that you don't get hana from are the aveiro. And then we fall back into the...
And then you see him as taking advantage of it.
Yeah, but then we're back to our original boundaries of...
So Yonina is along the lines of the Gra. The Gra, the Gaon Mivilna, put a much more limited reading on this Ramban and on this Rashba to say as follows, that you are only obligated to... This idea of only being obligated to perform your parents' wishes when they derive some tangible hana from it... But not being obligated when they do not, is only in a case where their request in some way prevents you from being able to fulfill some commandment. However, in any other case, where it's not going to stop you from performing some mitzvah, then the sky's the limit, and whatever it is they ask of you, you are to do. So that massively limits the Ramban and the Rashba, and just puts them only, basically, as Yonina was saying, as a subset of the Gemara in Yevamot. Let's just read that the line. The when if people ever learn the Gemara on Shulchan Aruch, he says very deep, big things in very small, very few words, and it can be a very difficult piece to learn. But if you just see those last words at the bottom of source number 8 that I made, V'ayin sham b'rashba shemashmeh midvarav, it implies from the Rashba, shedafka lidchot lav. He's only speaking about in a case where the parents' argument has been to push off some negative commandment. At that point we say, no, you're not going to derive any benefit from it. So I don't think that is the pshat of the Ramban and the Rashba. It's not the way in which most people have read it. But that would massively, massively restrict it. Shut Betzela Chochma is asked an extremely difficult question. This sort of gets to, I think, what Dorit was talking about. A very elderly parent who has, if I remember, it's a very, very long piece, whether or not to give the parent the full extent of their medical condition and understanding of it, which would likely only cause them distress and upset. They're probably not going to derive benefit from it. That's what the questioner thinks. Nevertheless, they have asked for it. So you see how suddenly this is a deeply painful question. They have asked to be kept fully informed of their situation. The child really feels that to do so would definitely not give them any sort of benefit whatsoever. So what would we say there? According to the Ramban and the Rashba, simple reading, you wouldn't have to tell them. They don't derive benefit. You're not obligated to do what your parents ask from when they don't get benefit. According to the Vilna Gaon's reading of it, you certainly would, because that idea only applied when it impinged on some other mitzvah. Rav Bezalel, I forget his second name, does not go with the Vilna Gaon. Rather, he sort of gives an interesting reading of it. The Gamla Ramban v'Arashba, kol she'ein bo hana la'av, ein bo mishu mitzvah kibud klal. Right, see that Pinchas, right? That's a pshat reading. That's a reading of the Rashba, just in a straight way where there's no hana to the parent, there is no mitzvah whatsoever. But he puts this sort of interesting limitation, right? Rak sevir alei, savruluhu rather, de blitam v'siba, but if there isn't reason, v'lo yavit la'avor tzivui ha'av, gam b'mididilet le ha'av hana minei. Meaning there has to be some compelling reason on the child's side to not do it, right? It's not just, oh, he doesn't have to, right? Because they're not deriving any hana from it. But there has to be some compelling reason for the child to not do that. It's sort of, if you like, it's, he's saying, to think about it in a more holistic manner. I'm not sure if it was Dan or Anina who said something along those lines, that it's definitely not capricious. Right? If it's capricious, then the Ramban and the Rashba would apply. Right? But rather, the father is asking for something which you would need a good reason in order to say that you're not going to respect their request. I remember Rav Gigi, my Rosh Yeshiva, had a very interesting sort of reading of this. If you remember in our very first shiur, we spoke about how Kibud Av Ve'em is not something unique to the Torah and the world of mitzvot. It's something that's practiced around the world. The Aruch HaShulchan had a very lovely idea that that's why we don't make a bracha on Kibud Av Ve'em, because the whole world performs it, and we can't say that we are uniquely sanctified with it. So says Rav Gigi, there's sort of both the halachic, if you like, specifically Jewish element, and then there's the universal element. So according to the halachic, sort of one way of looking at it, just the particular nature of the mitzvah and the definition of the mitzvah, then the Ramban and the Rashba apply, and you don't need to listen to your parents in any case where they don't derive hana from it. But, said Rav Gigi, and what he thinks is being hinted at here, there is also just the universal component, which means above and beyond any discussion about the definition of the mitzvah, just like Dama ben Natina, the goy from Ashkelon who wouldn't wake his father when offered lots of money, there's still the obligation to listen to one's parents. That is Betzela Chochma. Sefer HaMakneh very briefly has this idea that we're just talking within the context of kibud, right, of honoring parents, but there's also the additional parallel mitzvah of mora, of reverence. And if you remember, one of the elements of mora was lo soter et dvarav, of not contradicting them, right? So presumably, if a parent tells you to do something, even if they're not getting any hana from it, you are... and you decide not to, that would be to listor et divrehem, that would be to contradict them, right? Which really takes the ground out from underneath the Ramban and the Rashba. So we've seen three limitations so far. Very briefly, the Chazon Ish, and the Chazon Ish is based off the following story, which is worthwhile reading, and it's a strange and a difficult story. It's the Yerushalmi. Imo shel Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Yishmael's mother, ba v'kibolt alei l'rabotenu. She came to the Chachamim in the Bet Midrash. Amra lahen, she said to them, Giaro b'Yishmael, I need you to shout at Yishmael for me. B'ni, why? She'enu noheg b'kavod. He's not honoring me as he should. Oh, really? How is he not honoring you as he should? Could it really be Rabbi Yishmael doesn't honor his mother, one of the great Tanaim? Boto shan it kamu penehem shel rabotenu. Right, their faces are confused. Efsha Rabbi Yishmael lo nahag bichvod avotav. Could it be he doesn't honor his parents? Amrula, they said to her, what is it? Ma avidlech. What does he do? Amra, she says as follows. This is difficult to read. Kaddu nafak mi beit vada. When he comes back from the beit vad, from the meeting place. Ana bay mishigaz reglevi. What I want to do is I want to wash his feet. Or mishte mehen, and then drink the water which I've washed his feet with. Right, my son is such a great sage, one of the greatest of all. You know, what greater joy could there be for me than to drink the water which I wash his feet in? Obviously, Rabbi Yishmael says, never in a million years, Zima. Right, that's disgusting, that's vile. You know, no way could I submit to that. She says, you're my son, my beloved son, who's achieved so much. You know, allow me to do it. So what happened? They, Chachamim, say to him, and this is the following critical line, since it is her will, it is also her kavod. In other words, what is the ratzon of a parent? Is also their kavod, is also the honouring of a parent, right? Which seems to strike a completely different line from the idea of kibud avim is only limited to what is hana, what is the benefit they derive from it. According to this, whatever is their desire, that is their kavod. So the Chazon Ish, based on this, uses a phrase which is a phrase which confuses many people, and it's a very Chazon Ish phrase, what he calls ratzon shel Torah. Right, there is what the mitzvot say, what the halacha says you are supposed to do, and the halacha is like the Ramban and the Rashba, that kibud av ve'em is defined by what benefit they derive. But above and behind that, ratzon ha-Torah, the Torah's desire is that you honor your parents, and ratzonam hu kavodam, whatever it is they want, whatever it is they wish for, that is their kavod. Of course, people struggle with that idea because they say, what do you mean? What's Ratzon HaTorah? Ratzon HaTorah is the mitzvot. Ratzon HaTorah is the halachot, right? What isn't a mitzvah, what isn't a halacha, is not Ratzon HaTorah. If it was, it would be part of the mitzvot, right? Something you see, have people heard this idea before? Of Ratzon HaTorah being something sort of supra, like above the... You've heard it before? It's quite a hard thing to know what to do with, and like how do you define it? But it comes up in quite a few places. So that's the way in which he sort of squares the circle. Yes, according to the distinct halacha, only honor parents where they get hana from it. Ratzon ha-Torah, the Torah's desire, however, extend that. perhaps that leads nicely to what Dana was saying earlier about you know, that maybe there is a way to think about, even when a parent's demand might be extremely difficult to fulfill, there's a difference between not fulfilling it and not paying any attention to it whatsoever, right? There are many ways in which, you know, the blow or can be softened, or some way, some sort of discussion can be gone into over it. I'll just quickly show you the continuation of that, Gemara, just to show you sort of the sense of humour and also the pathos of this. And this is one of my favourite of all Gemarot in this area. Rabbi Zeira, I believe it's Rabbi Zeira, who was an orphan, I think in the Bavli this is Rabbi Yochanan, having mitzta'el, was greatly pained that he was an orphan. Va'amar, and he said, Halavai hayali abba v'ima, I wish I had parents. De'ekrinu de'nerot gan eden, right then I would be able to fulfill this mitzvah of kibud av v'em. An orphan wants parents to fulfill the mitzvah of kibud av v'em. But then he heard these Shama Ilun Tarti, and he heard these two stories, one of Rabbi Ishmael, another one about Rabbi Tarfon. And then what did he say? End of the last of the second to last line. Amar, he said, Baruch Rachmana, thank God, the lately Abba V'ima, that I don't have parents, right, that I'm an orphan. Loke Rabbi Tarfon, Havi Yachilna, Lema'aved, I wouldn't have been able to perform my mother's wishes like Rabbi Tarfon, Veloke Rabbi Ishmael, Havi Mekablena, nor would I have received my mother's wishes like Rabbi Ishmael. So just remember that, the idea that there were members of Chazal who thanked God that they were orphans for not having to struggle with what it is to be a child. Anyway, on to, and to finish with this lovely and famous Maharik, Rabbi Yosef Kolon, one of the lay Rabbanei Italia in the 15th century, and Romeo and Juliet is set in Italy, isn't it, right? Written, obviously, by Shakespeare, but set in Verona?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, excellent.
In the
15th century. Amazing. Mm-hmm. Well, we all know that Shakespeare didn't actually make up his stories, right? That Shakespeare got his stories from pre-existing folktales. So we assume...
He read the Maharik.
Well, I assume Shakespeare was going through Sherlock Vachuvot of the Maharik and then came up as follows. So a very, very complicated story, with the father being furiously opposed to his son's choice of wife. They weren't married. All the more complicated by the fact that there seems to have been some pre-existing relationship between the son and the young woman. And the father completely forbids the son, to have anything to do with her and to marry her. Does the son have to, and even made him force him to on it, does the son have to listen to his father? Guesses, people, before we... Will we give the name?
No.
Well, if they had a pre-existing relationship,
then
he have to
marry
God. Imagine what that relationship was is not clear. It wasn't anything that was.
That's how old you are.
Wait, did anyone say yes? No one said yes.
Oh. That he does have to listen.
Yeah. As he didn't know him.
Okay, so we won't read it inside, but let's work out the reasons. Halachic reasons, I assume people are agreed, why the son does not have to listen to his father.
Father doesn't get benefit.
Okay, Yofi, very good, Elisa. Right, the Rashba, which we've been talking about the whole time, right, Hana, which, if we're to go again with the point that was made by Naomi at the beginning, seems to be in some sort of physical sense. That is the definition of Kibud Av V'em. This is, outside of that, obviously, we don't have to listen to our parents. That was the Ramban, that was the Rashba. Very good, that's one of the Maharik's reasons, done.
Sometimes, unfortunately, a reason that parents don't want their daughter or son to marry someone is they say that, like, the other person's, like, taking them away from them.
Okay, Yofi, so that is also a question that is asked by Acharonim on exactly this Maharik. Would the Maharik's reasons also apply in a case where not only is the child marrying somebody that their parent doesn't want them to marry, but is also going to move overseas for them and therefore going to be unable to observe Kibud Av V'em? That is going to be a question which comes out of this situation. This Maharik really becomes the center of the sukya. Elise has given us one reason, right? The Rashba says that Kibud Av V'em is only limited to Hana. Another reason. Nina.
The opposite, actually. I was going to say why, halachically, you would have to obey your parents in this matter, because it's not that they're saying you to do something against
Oh, really, really? So the first time I ever heard of this Maharik was in a shiur given by Professor Jeffrey Wolf of Bar-Ilan, and it was entitled The Shidduch Crisis, or The Singles Crisis, from 15th century Italy till today, right? Based on this Maharik, that very clearly one of the other reasons, in addition to the one that Aliza said, that lies behind the Maharik rejecting it, is that, you know, finding somebody you want to marry and who wants to marry you is no simple thing, right? You know, we don't take that sort of thing for granted. And the Torah doesn't look neutrally at the idea of marriage, right? Building a home, peru revu, bringing children into the world. This is the very first mitzvah that there is, both in the Torah, Bereshit chapter 2, and in the Shulchan Aruch, Eben Ha'ezer, Simon Aleph, Sif Aleph. And the father is essentially telling his child to do something with for which they're not going to be able, if they listen to them, they're not going to be able to fulfill the Torah's first commandment. So that would seem to go back all the way.
Person. Like, it's not that their parents are saying that they shouldn't marry, it's that they shouldn't marry a specific person.
Right, but says the Maharik, couldn't he? Are you really going to, you know, be so confident that if you don't marry one person, you'll be able to find another person? This is not something we're going to take a gamble on, right?
That's their Besheret, and then you're going against them.
Ah, Besheret. Very, very, very good. Right, good one, Kay.
Number two's really good.
It's a Talmudic concept, so you're going against the will of God if you're going against the Besheret.
After Korban by it, there are multiple Besherets per person.
Okay. So leaving aside our Besheret, that essentially is the second answer. Right?
No, I thought like a good part would be like since you have to see her, like and then that would be going against it, like if it says, or like he says you have to marry this person, and then you can say no because it says in Torah you have to see her.
So what's that? What that is indicative of the idea that you have to see your future wife is that you should love. He then goes on to say, right? So all the Gemara which we saw early on in Yevamot, where your parent tells you to violate a mitzvah, you should not listen to them. It's part of that. So firstly, the Rashba. Kibud Horim, limited to Hana. Secondly, this is engaged, this would cross the line of not fulfilling another mitzvah. Third and final one, something we've mentioned in the past, actually, this is his first reason he gives, we'll just read this one. Chada da afilu le'inyan mamon. Even when it comes to monetary tensions between children and parents, right, when it comes to them fulfilling, honoring one's parents, so you might remember we talked about this, there is machloket as Michel Avu Michel Ben. Do you pay for your parents' needs from your own money or from your parents' money? And even though it's a machloket, we abide lahalacha, and this is not argued at all down the generations, that mishel av, right, that the parent is the one who pays for the costs that are incurred by kibud av ve'em. And says the Maharik, if this is so, that the Torah does not want to make a child pained by the honor of their parents when it comes to a financial sense, right, something b'mamono, kal v'chomer b'gufo, how much more so when it comes to something which, you know, would be any greater pain than not being able to marry the person which you would want to marry. So those are the three reasons that the Maharik gives to knock this father out of the water. Number one, we paskin Michel Av, not Michel Ben. Number two, the Rashba limited to Hana. Number three, that it touches on mitzvah. Yes, Pinchas.
The last reason you gave, I don't particularly like, because in the context of
Maharik,
the what's it called?
Mammon.
The concept of Mammon, you can still perform Ud'av with the father's Mammon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a matter of not causing you the additional inconvenience of having to use your own money in this context. It's not you could perform it, but you're going to do it in some way that's going to be less painful for you. It's a matter of not performing your father's will at all.
No, it seems like in the first one, if their father ran out of money, and you'd be cut to it from your own money.
So, no, certainly you would still, well, it would then come out of your tzedakah money, is the way in which Poskim seem to understand it. It's what the Maharik uses that idea for is to show what the halacha's approach would be, right? The halacha's understanding is that kibud av, whilst being such a great and significant mitzvah, nevertheless is not done at the expense of the child.
Only if you can still do it. Not at the expense of the child's. The cases are not the same.
I think what he's using it as for is not as it's to show if you can still do it, but as indicative of what Kibud Av is about it. That is that Mishel Av shows that Halacha's concern is still for the child's dignity to be maintained. Nevertheless, just to finish off the source, not on the sheet, I came across this late last night that Shevet HaLevi, Rav Waldenberg, one great posek who passed away a few years ago, I've probably mentioned him once or twice, writes at the very end of his Hilchot Kibud Av Ve'em that even though this is so and the Maharik is accepted and is the major source for this whole discussion, nevertheless, whenever practically he gets this question and he has asked this question, he always prefers to hold off with any sort of directive, hold off with any sort of answer, and to hope that parents and children will sort it out one way or another with one another. Perhaps the child will see the reason why their parents are saying what they're saying. Perhaps the parents will see where their children are coming from, rather than forcing it just as you could, based on the Maharik, that the son, to show that the son is right. Yashakach, everybody.
Wait, next week.
This week.